Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Economic studies show that while some places in Appalachia have shown signs of improvement, there's still a lot of work to do to bring back good-paying jobs to coal country. Why? Is there enough investment? What's being done and what could help?
A downtown that is developing, that is leaving people behind, isn't really developing.
We'll hear about a program that teaches people how to run their own farm as a business.
You know, if I want to sell 20 pounds, how do I figure out the number of plants I need? I didn't know how to do that. So this was a good program for that.
But as we'll hear, these projects don't always go as planned.
I definitely learned not to put all my eggs in one basket, that's for sure. We pretty much put all our eggs in this basket, and the basket got knocked off the table.
We're talking about the tough landscape of economic development inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Since the war on poverty in the 1960s, federal funds to help revitalize coal country have poured in from Washington, D.C., and in recent years, a new federal push has brought millions of dollars worth of funding to projects that are intended to create jobs and retrain people in coal country for work in other fields. There are also a number of state initiatives to help generate job growth. But have these projects worked? If pockets of our region are still declining economically, what can be done to make these projects more effective? On today's show, we'll hear about several programs that received federal funding to try to jumpstart economic development in Appalachia through agriculture. Some received money from the Appalachian Regional Commission, or ARC, a federal state agency that's been around more than 50 years since President Johnson signed the Appalachian Regional Development Act of 1965. Over the years, the ARC has funded infrastructure projects like interstates, highways, and water systems. When the newly appointed federal co-chair Tim Thomas took office about 3 months ago, he introduced the agency's top three priorities: helping communities predominantly dependent on the coal industry to rebound, addressing the opioid crisis, and working to support small businesses and entrepreneurship. Thomas says after doing a lot of traveling over the past 3 months, those priorities remain the same.
One thing that I would mention that has become more apparent in the last 6 months is just how interrelated these challenges are and how ARC's work on one front can potentially also have positive impacts on another. An example that I would point to would be the connection between a community's economic condition and addiction.
Thomas points out a link between a community's economic condition and substance use disorders. You'll find a map on the ARC's website that illustrates the most economically distressed counties in red. Not surprisingly, if you compare them with another map showing overdose death rates, you see the overlap. It's kind of a chicken and egg situation, and along those same lines, Thomas points out that a boost in economic opportunity can help those in recovery gain a sense of purpose and self-esteem.
So we have to equip our communities with the tools and resources to help open up employment opportunities. And to do that successfully, we have to know what they need.
And to find out what communities need, Thomas says the ARC is planning listening sessions across the region. He says the agency will continue to use the POWER initiative to support economic development. POWER stands for Partnerships for Opportunity and Workforce and Economic Revitalization, and its funding is approved by Congress. So far, it's invested more than $94 million in taxpayer money into projects that have touched about 250 communities in Appalachia's coal country. We reported earlier this year on an economic development project that was funded in part by a $1 million ARC power grant. The plan was to grow lavender on a former strip mine in West Virginia. After the story aired, we heard from a number of students involved in the program saying they were disappointed in it and felt misled by the promises of the project called Green Mining. Roxy Todd revisited the site to find out what happened and if the project is still going as expected.
First, some background. Back in 2014, then-West Virginia Governor Earl Ray Tomlin asked the West Virginia Regional Technology Park to come up with some ideas that could help generate new jobs for displaced coal miners in southern West Virginia. The idea that the CEO of the technology park, Rusty Krusaluk, had was to grow lavender on former strip mines.
The project for the Green Mining Project was one way that we thought that we could help take displaced mine workers and instead of a mining for coal, perhaps work on mine reclamation.
In 2016, the project was awarded grants through the Benedum Foundation, then the Appalachian Regional Commission, to fund the first couple of years of the green mining program. In the interest of full disclosure, both of these organizations have also provided funding to West Virginia Public Broadcasting. 17 other companies also donated time and resources toward the first phase of the Lavender Project. The Technology Park offered classes to teach people how to grow lavender, and they paid the students a $10 an hour stipend to attend classes. The project attracted 47 students in 2017, including several from out of state.
So we sold everything we owned, packed up our little car, drove 9 hours to West Virginia.
Veterans Deborah and her husband Scott Ritchie moved to West Virginia from Florida with their daughter because they heard about the green mining program.
Came here to be lavender farmers. We were supposed to get a deal to where once we graduate the school, they were supposed to give each vet, because both of us are vets, they're supposed to give each vet 2 acres of land. And we went to the school, graduated the school, and went to go talk about the land and nothing. No call back, no email return, nothing.
They say they were told that following the 6-week course, they would have the option of growing lavender on a mine site to help raise some supplemental income. But that didn't happen.
I definitely learned not to put all my eggs in one basket, that's for sure. Yeah. We pretty much put all our eggs in this basket, and the basket got knocked off the table.
Other students we spoke to said they had also been led to believe that they would be offered land to grow lavender on after their 6-week training course. Another veteran, Amber Stanley, lives just outside Charleston. She has a small garden, some chickens, and was looking forward to the opportunity to grow lavender up on the mine site.
Now I'm feeling pretty misled, and I also feel a little bit exploited.
So what happened? The project's main organizer, Rusty Krusilak, says the grant money simply ran out. They couldn't pay their staff anymore, so they couldn't continue the next phase of the project. I asked him what about the students who say they're disappointed, people like Amber, Scott, and Deborah.
We apologize if that's the impression. We weren't aware of that, but we certainly reached out in the springtime to as many people as we could, but we'll do everything we can to rectify that in the future.
An hour after we recorded this interview with Krusilak, a volunteer with the Green Mining Project did send an email to the former students asking if they would want to be a part of a new phase of their project, a lavender growing cooperative. The students from last year's class we talked to all said it was the first time they had heard from the program in 7 months. The idea behind the cooperative, in part, is to get former students to help maintain the existing lavender fields as volunteers. I visited the mine site to see how the plants had fared through the winter.
It's pretty quiet up here on the mine site. Not a lot of people. Black bear crossed in front of our path earlier, down below on the road. And we have some bullfrogs here in a little pond with cattails.
Not far from the cattail pond, the gray moonscape soil now has some purple growing on it. Nearly a year since I was here last, small plants of English and French varieties of lavender dot the rocky fields. A little over 3,000 of the lavender plants survived the winter. Krusilak says that's about half of what they planted last year. A few volunteers, and at least one person who's been paid part-time, has been up here in the past few months weeding the fields. Most of that weeding work has been done by Lori Bailey. She heard about the Lavender Project from a news story and reached out to see how she could get involved.
I was like, that is so cool. I mean, I just thought it was the greatest thing. Because there's so much land that's had mountaintop removal, and I just think it's great that trying to do something to make that look beautiful again.
But without Bailey and a handful of volunteers up here, the lavender plants might have been overtaken by weeds. That's still a risk if they don't find a way to keep the volunteers engaged or figure out how to pay people to keep maintaining these fields.
The last thing you want to do is go out and plant 2,000, 10,000 acres and then not have anybody to work it or not have anybody take care of it.
This is from an interview we recorded last year with one of the project's main organizers, Marina Sawyer.
If we don't have the workforce or the students coming out to do that kind of work, then you end up losing valuable plants. And that we're not about that either.
But a few months after this interview, Sawyer and the other staff were all let go because they were only contracted to work on a one-year grant, and the funding ran out. We reached out to the Appalachian Regional Commission, which funded the project last year, to ask them if they're happy with the project's outcomes. They didn't want to do an interview, but Wendy Wasserman, Director of Communications, sent the following statement. This project proves that Appalachia's coal-impacted communities are well-positioned for innovative economic development. The green mining team identified an asset, did the research, and literally got their hands dirty. Now a series of new value-added products using Appalachian-grown lavender are headed to market, end quote. Wasserman says the project was turned down for a second round of funding from the ARC because so many other projects applied for funding, and the application process was incredibly competitive this year. Meanwhile, Rusty Krusilak says that in a few years, he hopes these fields of lavender will be producing enough essential oil that they can earn some income for the project.
Well, most of our revenue down the road is going to be using shared processes. Once we get oil production, we're going to use the shared revenues to make the whole foundation self-sustaining.
And the technology park does have the equipment and the chemical expertise to produce that oil. But they won't be producing very much oil anytime soon, not for at least another year or two, until the lavender plants are big enough. So in the meantime, how will the project support itself, maintain the fields of lavender? Krusilak says although they didn't receive a second year of funding from the ARC's Power Plus program, he says they are going to try again later this fall. And he says the handful of volunteers will help keep it going. At this time, there are about 5 students still involved helping see the project grow. Not among them is Deborah and Scott Ritchie, who say they just don't know if they have trust in the program anymore.
So for me, this was a new chapter, new leaf, a new adventure, and I just got shot down. And it kind of put me back to that, well, why am I even trying thought process. So I was angry. I was real angry and disappointed.
She says it was nice to see the recent email that the project hasn't gone completely underground, but they don't have time to spend volunteering on the mine site, not at this time anyway. At this point, the Ritchies are just struggling to pay their own bills. Deborah got a job at a gas station, and her husband Scott is still looking for a job. They say they aren't sure if they'll stay in West Virginia or if they plan to leave the state in search of work. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
We'll be following that project to see what develops over the coming year. Here on Inside Appalachia, we've heard about projects like the Lavender one that are trying to promote economic development through farming. We've also heard just how tough it can be to make a living as a farmer. Still, West Virginia leads the nation in the number of small farms. And if small-scale agriculture could scale up, even a little, economists say it could have big benefits. But food systems in the Mountain State also face challenges, namely the hilly geography and sprawling population. Brittany Patterson spent some time in Talkett, West Virginia, where one group is trying to grow the state's local food economy by thinking holistically.
It's about 8 a.m. on a recent Monday morning, as the rising sun burns off the low-hanging fog and fishermen haul in their morning catches from the Greenbrier River. At Sprouting Farms, the day is well underway. Produce has been harvested and safely stored in a giant refrigerator. Employees are packaging cherry tomatoes, activities you might find at any of the farms that dot the Greenbrier Valley. But while the daily tasks are handled at this production-scale vegetable farm, the crux of Sprouting Farms' mission goes beyond the fields at hand.
So I feel like, you know, the demand is there. I've never really had that issue. It's just, how do we get supply and demand to line up, and how do we get the infrastructure in the middle to sort of pull it all together?
Sprouting Farms project director Fritz Bettner takes me on a tour of the 83-acre farm. The goal of this project is to break down barriers, physical, financial, and market-based, so farmers can be successful in West Virginia. While no one thought it would be simple, over the last year, the project has learned a lot of lessons.
We still have a long way to go in making that happen.
As we walk out of a faded red barn, a row of white plastic-covered greenhouses or high tunnels looms in front of us. Some of the 30 greenhouses are used by Sprouting Farms itself, but others are rented by local farmers who may not have the space or ability to invest thousands of dollars into the equipment needed to be a farmer.
So this high tunnel is one of our renters, and she rents monthly. This is her second year. And here we're not even talking about food. She rents it and has a cut flower business. And so she grows a lot of these flowers for, you know, weddings and restaurants and things like that.
An abundance of bright pink and yellow flowers adorn the high tunnel. Sunflowers peek out merrily from the back. Renters pay $30 per month for a 30 by 100 foot high tunnel. That includes electricity and water. For a few dollars more, they can use the farm's tools, including the tractor.
This offers her the opportunity. I mean, if she had to go buy her own high tunnel and invest all the infrastructure, that was too much. But this was an opportunity for her to grow her business here.
But what if you want to be a farmer, but you don't know how?
I'm Ruby Daniels, and I go by Ruby D.
Beckley resident Ruby Daniels came to Sprouting Farms in March to participate in the project's apprenticeship program. Daniels' family history is steeped in farming. Her great-grandfather was a slave who came to West Virginia to cut coal out of the seams before that job was done by machine. After he was injured, the family ran an orchard and a restaurant in the area. Daniels has a master's degree in science and therapeutic herbalism, and owning her own farm has long been a dream.
But I didn't know how to figure out the numbers. Like, how do I figure out if I need 20, you know, if I want to sell 20 pounds, how do I figure out the number of plants I need? I didn't know how to do that. So this was a good program for that.
She shows me some of the things she has planted in the 200 square foot high tunnel she shares.
So that's comfrey right there, bee balm. So I'll put some more in there. These are my green beans that I just harvested. So some more are coming out. And these are fill peas. And there, see the, that's the pea. And that's what they'll start filling with, like beans.
She makes herbal teas and tinctures with the herbs she grows and says Sprouting Farms has given her the tools she needs to expand.
This is like a good farm for teaching an apprentice or somebody that doesn't know about farming, because you can see things, and everybody does farming different.
Bettner, the project manager of Sprouting Farms, says by running their own production farm, they can workshop the best ways to grow on a larger scale in West Virginia, which doesn't have big swaths of flat land like the Midwest or California. Andy says the farmers who rent or train here also benefit from having the staff and tools on site.
And so one day I could say, you know, rent two greenhouses and here's an acre and you can make a living doing it. The hope would be one day that would be possible. Not only like you can do that, but here's exactly what, you know, you could grow right now in order to do that. And we could offer that assistance.
In 2017, Sprouting Farms received a $1.5 million grant from the Appalachian Regional Commission. The project was an inaugural recipient of ARC's Power Initiative, which provides federal dollars to coal-impacted communities. The goal is to diversify and help these economies. Coal mining isn't common here in Summers County, unlike in many southern counties in the state. But the region has long supported the coal fields and timber camps by producing food for hungry workers. Today, coal trains run right alongside the farm 3 to 4 times per day, a striking reminder of the state's long history with extractive industries. But while the ARC grant has helped launch Sprouting Farms, Bettner says there's still a big obstacle before agriculture is a viable economy of scale here.
But we know that here, the markets are a challenge.
That's true for small farmers across the country, says Todd Schmidt, associate professor at Cornell University, who studies agribusiness development in rural communities.
The market access issue, particularly in thinking about collaborative marketing operations, cooperatives, food hubs, is something that is providing beneficial to small-scale producers.
Food hubs are a centralized location where farmers can bring their food for processing and to go to market. Schmidt says across the country, food hubs are expanding as more restaurants, grocery stores, and other institutions seek more local food because increasingly their customers ask for it. And food hubs can hugely benefit small farmers, of which West Virginia has many. The state leads the nation in small farms. Of the more than 20,000 farms here, 97% of them are considered small, and 93% are family-owned, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But making a full-time living off farming alone isn't feasible for most small farmers. Most vegetable farmers in West Virginia bring in less than $50,000 a year. Once expenses are accounted for, it's hardly a good living. Selling more produce or higher-value produce to restaurants or grocery stores could help. Food hubs become the middlemen, but in a good way. Farmers tell the hub what they have to sell. The hub aggregates it and delivers it to buyers. A restaurant may be getting squash from four different farms, but it's delivered by just one entity, the hub. Having access to a food hub has been a benefit to Roger Dolan, who owns the Wild Bean in downtown Lewisburg. The hip coffee shop also serves vegetarian fare and does a rockin' trade in smoothies.
We usually go through about 15 pounds of mixed greens a week. We get spinach, tomatoes, green peppers, cucumbers, lots of kale, which we use in our green smoothies and salads and make soups with.
Dolan has always tried to source as much of the produce the Wild Bean uses locally, but says it was hard juggling communications with multiple farms to get what he needed. Then he found a food hub. He says, sure, sometimes there are challenges, but overall, it's a boom to business to be able to advertise that they use local food.
We're putting money right back into our local economy by supporting local farmers that are going to come to our shop and spend their money. You know, it's just like a cycle. We're each helping each other out.
And this fall, the two largest food hubs in the southern and eastern portions of West Virginia are converging.
We're trying to achieve some economies of scale here, and hopefully to get West Virginia agriculture products into bigger markets.
Brandon Dennison is the founder of the Coalfield Development Corporation, which runs a farmer training program called Refresh Appalachia. Its food hub in southern West Virginia will join Sprouting Farms' to become the Turnrow Appalachian Farm Collective. That means more local food will be available to buyers on a much larger scale. The West Virginia Department of Agriculture estimates West Virginians consume $8 billion worth of food annually, but the state only produces $800 million. If this food hub can boost the amount of locally produced food bought by West Virginians by just a few percentage points, it could have big returns, says Jim Mattson, an agricultural economist based in South Carolina.
We're not trying to replace every amount of food that comes in there with local food in most cases. We're just trying to add a little bit to it that can help to support these local families, add to local communities.
Back at the farm, Bettner and I climbed to the top of a hill to get the bird's eye view of Sprouting Farms. As we look out over the land, he reflects on the work they've accomplished so far.
I mean, I'm happy with the progress that we've made, absolutely, what we've been able to accomplish. But also, you know, there's like an extremely long way to go.
Bettner says as the project goes into its second year, it does so with more data and feedback on what has worked so far and what hasn't. But one thing he doesn't question is people's appetite for more local food.
Sort of our goal is not just to make this site work, but like make the whole, you know, regional food system work. And we have lots of farmers and partners that are very interested in seeing that happen.
Sprouting Farms has two more years of federal funding from the ARC for the first phase of their project. They're hoping that in the meantime, they can find a way to be more self-sustaining, bringing a profit to their organization to continue after the grant runs out. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Brittany Patterson in Talcott, West Virginia.
Over a 10-year period ending in 2015, coal jobs declined 27% in central Appalachia. This work had long been one of the only good-paying careers in the region and helped to support small businesses and communities. We just heard about two projects that received federal funding through the ARC's Power Initiative for Agriculture Projects. Federal dollars have also funded programs to train former miners in computer coding, welding, robotics, and other fields. Over a 10-year period ending in 2015, coal jobs declined 27% in central Appalachia. This work had long been one of the only good-paying careers in the region and helped to support small businesses and communities. We just heard about two projects that received federal funding through the ARC's Power Initiative for agricultural projects. Federal dollars have also funded programs to train former miners in computer coding, welding, robotics, and other fields. There's a pretty solid bipartisan agreement that something needs to be done to help bring jobs to coal country. But there's no magic bullet. I talked about this with ARC co-chair Tim Thomas. Here's more of our conversation.
How do you look to evaluate the success of these initiatives like the Power Plus grants? That's a lot of money that's going into states across Appalachia.
Well, it certainly is. We do have systems in place to evaluate all of our investments, whether it's through the Power Initiative or our other funding mechanisms. We are constantly talking with our grantees and our state partners to validate outcomes and impacts, and also to provide assistance to those projects that might be underperforming for whatever reasons. If there is a problem, we want to know about it. ARC has a lot of in-house expertise to provide technical assistance to help guide grantees along or help our partners navigate through unexpected challenges. So we maintain ongoing relationships over the course of the grant, which for Power is typically 3 years. But Power is different, and it does require a different evaluation strategy because it is a different investment strategy. These are often stretch projects aiming towards transformation. Many of these projects are premised on new ideas. They encompass wider multi-jurisdictional service areas and have more partners at the table than perhaps our traditional grants would see. They are also rooted in a long-term vision. And sometimes that innovation comes with a higher price tag and additional complexity. We know that, and so does Congress, which is trusting us to deploy these resources wisely and responsibly. One way to evaluate the Power Initiative is to look at the demand. We recently closed the application season for Power FY18, as I mentioned, which made $50 million available to coal-impacted communities. The response was overwhelming. We actually had requests for over $330 million worth of projects and ideas. That's nearly six times more than what we had to allocate. A lot of good projects didn't get funded, quite frankly. Some projects that we would like to have seen funded, but the demand was just too great to allow that. The projects were ranked competitively, but that does tell us that the demand and the momentum is there for economic diversity, that communities are ready and eager to try new ideas and stimulate new opportunities.
What role does self-reporting play in the measure of success in the Power Plus grants? And was that part of the importance in finding that private firm to help out with things? Was it an issue?
Well, now, self-reporting is important. That's part of having an ongoing relationship. We want these grantees to be comfortable telling us early on if they are encountering challenges they hadn't expected, so that we can assist them in a collaborative fashion. But it is not just self-reporting. As I said, we are hiring a neutral outside firm to review the investments. So we have checks in place on self-reporting. You can't just rely exclusively on that. We also have an inspector general that reviews a certain number of projects annually, and we have a hotline for fraud and abuse, so we are not just relying on self-reporting. But we want the grantees to know that we want their projects to succeed, and we want to assist them through any rough spots so that the project can be successful in the end.
How does the ARC work to make sure that there is a level of comfort with folks and grantees within the communities who have these grants that might, you know, not feel quite as comfortable reaching out if there is a challenge or a problem that they're not sure how to address?
We encourage them to pick up the phone and call us, you know, and that is something that is emphasized early on in the process and every step of the way. We are trying to build relationships. ARC is really about partnerships, and partnerships that also includes, you know, when there's a problem, you know, you need to let your partner know and then work through it together in that partnership fashion. So we encourage that. A lot of our grantees, frankly, we've worked with in the past. You know, the Power Project may not be the first effort we've worked on with them.
I wanted to get into how government funding can work in partnership with nonprofit organizations and for-profit companies within the private sector. How do you see private investment interacting with public funding in a way that's best for the Appalachian region?
Well, we see it a lot. Just about every ARC investment in the region requires matching funds. It can be local public dollars or private investment. This is actually in our statute, our authorizing statute, to leverage additional investment into the region and to help our communities realize that other funding partners are the key to success. We have a pretty good track record of leveraging additional funds, including private funds. And while we don't invest directly into private for-profit companies, we are helping communities prepare for and partner with those businesses. That might mean things like developing a local workforce, which makes a community more attractive for private business to locate there. Or it may mean basics like enhancing the local infrastructure to help communities be more competitive in attracting that new industrial facility. So there's very much a place for private investment. We like to see it. We like to see as much of it as we can to maximize the impact of federal dollars.
With those private dollars, are there any dangers or concerns with it? Do these types of private-public partnerships give more control to the companies or to the philanthropies who invest in the projects?
Well, the grant agreement itself sets those parameters, and ARC, we are very much involved in putting together any grant agreement that ARC dollars go to. We control that agreement. So we have a level of control here before we commit federal dollars, so we are comfortable with the private investment and the role of the philanthropy or whoever else might be involved. But ultimately, the real control of the project lies with those who execute it at the community and state level, regardless of the investor or partner. And a common interest for any funder, public, private, or otherwise, is for the investment to be successful. Success drives the bottom line. And success comes in many forms. It could be creation of good-paying jobs, which is obviously one hallmark of success. It could mean making sure there are well-qualified workers to fill those jobs. It could mean making sure that skilled workers continue to come through the pipeline. But success means that there is a long-term vision and commitment to our communities and their economies and being committed every step of the way. We don't need or want drop-in businesses who promise us roses in 5 or 10 years but continue to deliver us weeds in the meantime. We want partnerships that are meaningful in the short and long term.
Sometimes I think about the word dependent is tossed around when it comes to government assistance or investment. Maybe you think this might satisfy, with the private investors, the word dependent and those who might have concerns about that with the private investors?
Well, I think so. It's the private dollars ultimately that are going to really be transformational. We are just leverage funding, sometimes helping a project or an idea get to a critical mass point so that others see the value in it. But at the end of the day, it's the private investment that will certainly outweigh anything we do.
Tim Thomas, federal co-chair of the Appalachian Regional Commission, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jessica.
Since 2015, West Virginia has received funding for 34 power initiative projects. Kentucky got 20, Pennsylvania and Virginia both received 13, and Tennessee was awarded 4. We've posted a link on our website where you can find more information about all the projects that have been funded through this program. We often report on some grim statistics in our region, but there are some signs that a few places are making progress. Although poverty rates in both Appalachia and the nation dropped in the last year, Appalachia's poverty rates continue to be higher than the rest of the country. But according to an ARC report, fewer counties across our region will be considered economically distressed in the 2019 fiscal year. That's the best economic outlook the region has seen in a decade. Data about unemployment, poverty, and per capita market income levels went into the analysis. But it's not good news for all of Appalachia. In some areas, there's been an increase in the number of counties that are considered economically distressed. About 20 counties across Appalachia, in Alabama, Georgia, Kentucky, Mississippi, Ohio, Virginia, and West Virginia, have fallen on tougher economic times in the past year, many of which are located in what were the region's prime coal-producing areas. After the break, our producer Roxy Todd visits an abandoned apple orchard on an old strip mine.
None of them are alive. It's a few sticks sticking out of the ground. The ground itself is really dry and arid. This is a former mine site, so it's pretty dry here.
We continue to explore the tough landscape of economic development after a quick break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Can apples grow on an abandoned mine site? That's a question the West Virginia National Guard is spending more than $5 million to find out. The Guard has 1 year left of this three-year project. Roxy Todd traveled to Nicholas County, West Virginia, to find out how the first batch of apple trees are doing.
$30 million was given to West Virginia in 2016 to invest in economic development projects across the state. The money came from the 2015 Omnibus Federal Spending Bill passed by Congress, and there was a catch to this money. Groups would have to build their projects on former abandoned mine land sites. The idea was partly to spur new jobs in coal country, but also to speed up reclamation of mine sites. Some of the funding went to develop industrial parks, and others went to agricultural projects, like this one, managed by the West Virginia National Guard. Sergeant Major Daryl Sears walks me up a hillside. We're in a small community called Muddlety in Nicholas County. Behind an electric fence, rows of young apple trees are growing as far as my eyes can see.
The majority of this AML property up here you can plant the fruit trees on. Some of it needs a little bit of help in the sign of lime and fertilizer and balance to the pH, but honestly, almost every soil in West Virginia does.
These 3,000 trees are expected to live about 30 years. They aren't producing many apples yet. They're only 2 years old. And they're tiny, a type of dwarf apple tree that will need to be trellised. There are different varieties, but most are a type of apple that was developed in West Virginia, the famous Golden Delicious. Sergeant Sears says they're sweet, and that makes them great not only for eating, but has also attracted a major private investor, a producer of apple juice and apple vinegar.
So we already have a potential partner to develop further, but it hasn't been anything official. If they don't come, somebody else will.
If that type of private investment pans out, this orchard could eventually provide about 400 jobs and $1.5 million in tax revenue for the state, according to an economic impact study done by West Virginia University. Sears and 9 other employees work at this orchard now. By the end of next year, he says they'll have planted 250,000 trees on this site. But not everyone is convinced this plan is the best scenario. Commissioner of the West Virginia Department of Agriculture, Kent Leonhardt, says he'd love to see the National Guard's project succeed, but he has questions about their approach.
Why did they choose juicing apples when juicing apples are the lowest value of an apple that there is out there? Why aren't we going after table apples and a processing plant where we can cut them up into the sizes that our youth need in our schools?
Using some of the apples for eating is still part of the National Guard's plan, but they're hoping that by bringing in a larger company, the project will have more long-term investment beyond the current grant cycle, which ends next year. Another question Commissioner Leonhardt has is, why is the National Guard investing in agriculture? Adjutant General Hoyer, the man in charge of the West Virginia National Guard, says their job is not only to deal with natural disasters, but also to help find ways to solve economic and environmental challenges.
We as a state have to start thinking a little bit differently.
And that includes looking beyond coal for ways to use the land that's been left behind by years of mining.
I think our role from a guard perspective is to take that property and turn it into something for West Virginia's future.
But is a mine site really a suitable place to grow an apple orchard?
And it all depends on the type of soil that you've got and its productivity potential.
This is Jeff Skousen, a professor of soil science at West Virginia University and an expert in reclamation of mine sites. He estimates there are about 500,000 to 600,000 acres of abandoned mine land sites in West Virginia. Some have been reclaimed or cleaned up. Others have not.
And I would guess that probably a fourth of that area might be suitable for farming.
Most of this abandoned mine land is still owned by mine companies or private landowners, but it could be developed into a post-mining industry, like growing apples, if the soil is free of contaminants and if there are enough nutrients to support farming. Skousen helped the National Guard select the site for their Nicholas County orchard, and he tested the soil.
These soils are not toxic. There's nothing wrong with them. They're just fairly coarse, and by that I mean they're rocky. And so that means that they don't hold as much water and hold as many nutrients.
He advised the guard to add more potting soil to the dirt to give more nutrients and to help break up the tough clay. He says he's hopeful the trees will continue to thrive and produce, but it will be a few more years till they'll know for sure if they were successful. But an earlier apple tree project the National Guard was involved in was not. I went to Clay County to have a look at the apple trees.
None of them are alive. There's a few sticks sticking out of the ground. The ground itself is really dry and arid. This is a former mine site, so it's pretty dry here.
This project was headed up by a nonprofit called the Central Appalachia Empowerment Zone, and the West Virginia National Guard helped plant all the trees in 2015. I asked General Hoyer about this earlier project.
The follow-up on those trees is not like the follow-up in the orchard that we have at Muddle Tea.
You don't think it's an indication of the poor soil quality?
No, I think it was a matter of they just didn't have the folks to care for the trees. So I think it's two completely different circumstances.
According to the State Department of Environmental Protection, the site where these apples were planted was mined by Greendale Coal, which had its permits revoked in the late 80s. The agency says reclamation was later done on the soil, but there is an issue with acid mine drainage. It's not exactly clear if any of these environmental issues had anything to do with why the apple trees died. The organization that headed up this project, the Central Appalachia Empowerment Zone's executive director, Connie Lupardis, didn't want to do a recorded interview about this project. She says she was told by the DEP that the site would be appropriate to grow apples, and they did grow initially. She says they only received a little more than $20,000 for this pilot project, and if she had to do it all over again, she would make sure she has workers in place to care for the trees once they're growing. I asked Jess Skousen, the soil scientist, if he knows anything about the first apple project and why he thinks the apple trees in Clay County died. He hasn't been to that site or tested the soil, but he says that, generally speaking, if the reclamation on a mine site wasn't completed, then it's probably not the ideal location to grow apple trees.
So we do have to be careful about sites like that.
For multiple reasons, Skousen says, the second orchard location in Muddle Tea is probably better suited for growing apples. That site was last mined in 1969, and though there is still some reclamation needed on the property, he's hopeful that the soil and water quality will be able to support an orchard. The challenges in the first pilot project in Clay County did help the National Guard realize they needed some help. So they consulted with some fruit researchers at the Appalachia Fruit Research Station in Kearneysville, West Virginia. They're working with the Guard to help find the apple varieties that grow the best on the Muddle Tea site. They're also helping them grow some other fruit on this location, says Chris Dardirk, one of the scientists.
In our stone fruits, we have a trait we call super sweet, and these are nectarines and peaches that have just tremendous flavor profiles.
And they're also working on finding a way to help the National Guard grow pears, peaches, nectarines, plums, and even a kiwi variety that was developed specifically for West Virginia. I admit that the enchantment of growing these exotic fruits on a former mine site does sound enticing. Still, I can't help but wonder, are these projects just the byproduct of the coal industry and people who support coal? Are they just trying to prove these lands aren't completely wasted? I posed the question to Jeff Skousen.
No, I understand. I think you're trying to say, you know, is it people like me that are trying to justify continuing to destroy the environment to get coal out? And then, yes, there is a post-mining land use that we can develop and that we can move on and that these have value.
He says that he looks at the positive side of all this, that just 40 years ago, mining companies were doing much more damage to the environment without much work being done to reclaim their mine sites. Convincing coal companies to do a better job has taken a lot of work and federal regulation. Back up at the Muddle Tea site, Sergeant Sears says another generation from now, apples and other fruit trees could be one of the things covering these hillsides.
And he says he does think this project will be more successful than the Clay County project.
And as far as them doing better here than over there, I mean, it's just a matter of testing. I mean, to see, you don't know until you get them going, but they appear at this point, and you'll be able to see when you go up here, they're doing quite well here.
He says in about 4 years, we'll know for sure. That's when the 250,000 trees they're planting for this pilot project are expected to start producing apples. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Muddleti, West Virginia.
Federal dollars meant to help stimulate job growth have been pouring into the communities across Appalachia for over 50 years. But is it enough? And what could help people at the ground level get more leverage out of these federal funds? Leaders at the West Virginia Community Development Hub are exploring those very questions. The Hub is a nonprofit that's trying to help strengthen economic development efforts. Its research shows West Virginia communities have not seen improvement despite an influx of significant investment. That's because some towns lack consistency, alignment, and capacity at the local level to take advantage of resources and services. Yeah, this means sometimes residents just don't step up or they step on someone's toes. The Hub's community development model gets key local residents involved in the process, including representatives of the public, private, and civic sectors. Roxy Todd went to speak with the Hub's executive director, Stephanie Tyree. Tyree points to Princeton, West Virginia in Mercer County as a town where that approach has worked.
So for the last 10 or more years, there's been a project in Princeton called the Princeton Renaissance Project that's been focused on revitalizing their downtown Main Street, bringing in new businesses to vacant buildings, and to growing an arts community. They've invested in that as one of the transition opportunities for their region. But they also recognize that they have to bring in all new types of businesses. So they're really looking at how do they layer in all types of potential industries while really concentrating on this arts as a transformational impact.
So what about outside West Virginia? Are there examples that you've seen that might help us think about what's next here in West Virginia?
So a couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to travel with a group of leaders from Central Appalachia, and we went and visited coal mining regions in Germany and looked at how economic transition had been undertaken there. There were some interesting models that I saw over there, some of which I think are relevant to West Virginia, and some of which gave me good lessons about the increased investment that we're going to need in order to really help communities grow and transform in the state. In the Ruhr region, there has been a successful transition from the coal economy, and the coal mining in that region has mostly stopped. And they had a three-part way of moving forward and diversifying their economy. First, they had significant investment from public and private sectors. So they had almost $20 million invested in one town that we were in from the public sector, and $100 million invested from the private sector. So that's a level of investment we're talking about if that much money was invested in a town like Charleston, you know, or a town like Morgantown. What we see right now is that there is investment coming into the region, but it is in no way at that level.
Here in West Virginia, there's investment, but it's not at the level that you saw in Germany.
Yeah, we're seeing investment coming into West Virginia, into Central Appalachia, and that investment is important and needed and can lead to transformations, but it's not at the level that they had in Germany, and I think it's not at the level that we need and that we should expect to see in order to move forward our economy. They also had a commitment to transitioning the people working in the industry. And so this is something that is about real leadership. So they made a commitment that every miner was moved into a job, a new job, or into retirement. And that's, I think if you had that kind of commitment to an industry that's going through a transition, that would have a transformational impact on how people feel about that transition. But the third thing, and an equally critical thing, was that they really recognize that it's a cultural shift too. And so there was leadership around being willing to talk about how the region traditionally was seen as a certain thing and was under transition, and that was okay. and people felt like they could undertake that transition. There was leadership from elected officials in bringing community members together in an engagement process to talk about what that future looked like and what they wanted to build together.
And so that kind of brings us to state-sponsored programs. Let's talk about what the legislature could do this session.
So there's a lot of issues that the legislature could work on that would be very impactful for community development and for the communities that we work on. One of the key issues that we see as a need and a challenge in every single community in West Virginia is vacant and dilapidated buildings. It's also an issue where we have seen bipartisan support in the legislature, and we've seen leadership over multiple years from both parties in both chambers. So there's a real commitment, I think, to address this challenge, but it's a multi-layered challenge that's going to take a level of energy and leadership that it hasn't yet received. Looking at tax policy around dilapidated buildings isn't always the most exciting or interesting topic, and so it sometimes sort of falls under the radar during the legislative session. But we think it is a topic and an issue that could have a transformational impact on communities. There's a group that we work with called the Abandoned Properties Coalition that each year puts forward a series of proposals on how the legislature can address abandoned dilapidated properties. So I would hope that the legislature would look into those policies this year and take some leadership on the issue.
Again, that was Stephanie Tyree, Executive Director for the West Virginia Community Development Hub, speaking with Roxy Todd. If you've driven through any small town in coal country, you've probably noticed boarded up vacant storefronts. But like Princeton, there are other communities that are working to change that and find ways to bring businesses to their once bustling main streets. Wheeling, West Virginia, up in the Northern Panhandle near Pittsburgh, is another one of these communities that's bringing new businesses to their downtown. The city is among the top 10 contenders this year for the National Great American Main Streets Award. One of the nonprofit groups working to revitalize the town is Wheeling Heritage. Glennis Board spoke with the executive director, Jake Daugherty, about the work his organization is doing to reinvent its city.
Here in Wheeling, you guys have become like an example, right? I mean, throughout the nation. Can you talk a little bit about how that is and what it is that you're doing so well?
We are very clearly committed to creating enabling environments for people of all shapes and sizes, from helping developers be able to more successfully develop our beautiful architecture to providing small grants to artists so that they can continue practicing their craft. We're working in that whole range. You know, it's our philosophy that the person closest to the problem is probably the best person suited to solve the problem. So how can we continue to get resources as close as possible? And so I think that's one of the reasons why we've been really successful, is that just a commitment and a strong effort to continue to figure out what those enabling environments are and to distribute leadership throughout the community.
You know, you've talked a little bit about how there's a really changing and evolving sort of dynamic community here. Are you seeing the community change as far as the makeup, and what does that look like?
I think that we're seeing community members become more engaged. And I think that that's really exciting because you're starting to see leadership happen outside of these particular institutions that are kind of awarded leadership roles. So you've got these legacy organizations that have been around and have been doing great things. What I say is they've a lot of times steadied the ship through the hardest decades. And right now, the work that we're doing really builds upon those efforts. And today, you're seeing leadership come in all forms. It's coming in, you know, new residents who have moved into neighborhoods and are just excited to be here and see potential in Wheeling because they have fresh eyes. And you're also seeing it in longtime residents who are rediscovering the city. I think it's really exciting because it continues to build upon what is best about Wheeling, which is its people and its unique sense of place. You know, it's my hope, and I think it's our goal to continue to engage diverse audiences in our work and continue to reach new people and provide them with resources that will help make them more successful.
Mm-hmm. So what's next then? You were named a semifinalist, and then in March you're going to find out, right?
Yeah, that's right. In March in Seattle, Washington, there will be an announcement, and I think we fully intend to celebrate winning. And so that'll be a really exciting time. But I think the question of what's next is a great one. You know, it's very clear that as you walk down the street in Wheeling that the work isn't done. You know, we've seen a decrease in vacancy rates from 32% to 15%, but 15% is not the goal, you know. So we'll continue to work on new and innovative programs that help to solve that problem. And one thing that I always look at is the census tracts that comprise or surround downtown Wheeling. It has a residence or a population of about 7,700 people, but there's still really high unemployment. And there's still really high poverty. Mm-hmm. So it's really important for our work that it is engaging to everybody that lives in Wheeling and that it's to benefit everybody who lives in Wheeling. Because a downtown that is developing, that is leaving people behind, isn't really developing. And so we're really focused on that sustainable development that allows our neighborhoods and our downtown to really thrive.
Is there any particular project that you see coming or that, you know, investment that you've seen that you're especially excited about?
The Wheeling-Pittsburgh Steel Building development, which has been announced softly, which is a 144,000 square feet development in the center of our city, which will be converted into a mixed-use building with commercial and market-rate housing, is very, very exciting because it defines a shift in Wheeling. You know, that building used to be made up of workers in a very strong industry here in Wheeling, and that's just not the case anymore. These buildings that were built for that cause have a new use and a new economy here in the city. And so as we reuse these historic buildings, like the Wheeling Pitt Building, it's important to think about not only that it's hitting the tax rolls and that it's full, but that it defines a real clear shift in what the future of Wheeling and what the future of West Virginia looks like.
Well, great. Jake Daugherty, Executive Director of Wheeling Heritage, I really appreciate you coming and talking with me about this. And congratulations.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
That was Jake Daugherty, Executive Director of Wheeling Heritage, speaking with Glennis Board. And in the interest of full disclosure, one of Daugherty's employees who heads up the Main Street Initiative in Wheeling is a member of the Friends of West Virginia Public Broadcasting Board. His name is Alex Weld. You know, the folks in Wheeling and Princeton are celebrating the progress on a journey to a new identity with different jobs. But this success story doesn't look like New York City or Charlotte, North Carolina. It looks like Wheeling and Princeton with all the quirky uniqueness. But small businesses like coffee shops, restaurants, or art galleries can't stay in business without some sort of larger employer. We heard about a few agriculture projects far off the main streets in West Virginia meant to help create jobs and help the economy. But it's not easy. It's tough to make a good living as a farmer in this region. It comes with a unique set of geographical and logistical challenges. It's not hard to look around and find broken promises or unfinished projects that we deal with here in parts of Appalachia. But as we heard in the show, the ideas only work when there is total commitment on all levels, including federal, state, town, and yes, the people. It sounds cheesy, but you have to want it and believe it can happen before it will. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Dog and Gun, Strictly Clean and Decent, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Glennis Board and Molly Bourne edited our show this week. Molly is our web editor. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories at wvpublic.org, and you can find Inside Appalachia on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.